Welcome to Oh God, What Now? The podcast that has just won the double Podmasters Podcast Championship and Podmasters Seniors Podcast Cup. Very exciting. Thank you. I'm Alex Andreu. On today's show, all aboard the Starmer bandwagon. Does it feel like the media is starting to pivot towards the Labour leader? And should we get Aggie when Labour mentions Maggie? We discuss the controversy of the Labour front bench deploying the Iron Lady. Now, let's meet the panel. First up, it's Associate Political Editor at The New Statesman, Rachel Cunliffe. Hello, Rachel.
Hello.
And Hugo Rifkin is a columnist for The Times and a Times Radio host. Hi, Hugo.
Hello.
Can we take a moment to discuss the allegations that China proxies hacked the Electoral Commission? Rachel, how significant does this story feel?
It feels pretty significant. I mean, this was meant to be a day that was kind of, it wasn't quite recess, but it was pre-recess and there wasn't meant to be a huge amount going on. And Westminster has been really on sort of high alert all day because of it. The idea that China is trying to...
A bit late now to be on high alert.
Well, a certain amount of shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted and all that. I don't think it will come as a huge surprise that Chinese spies have been trying to access all kinds of things that they shouldn't have been. I think the scale of the cyber attack is quite significant. 40 million people's details are on the Electoral Commission files, and also the targeting of specific MPs as well. I think what is more significant has been the reaction, the sanctions on two specific Chinese individuals and one entity, and the fact that maybe this will be the turning point when Parliament really takes the threat of China seriously. Although China spends a lot of money and invests a lot of money in the UK, so that's a bit of a point of tension for them.
The estimable Garrick Club member and Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden made a statement on this. Has there been much of a reaction?
Well, Ian Duncan Smith, who's one of the MPs who was targeted, was not too happy with the statement. I think his exact words were, the response was like an elephant giving birth to a mouse, which was not an image that I really know what to do with. But what he's basically said is that it's too little, too late. But I think there's a real concern, particularly among China Hawk MPs who've been warning about this for years and years and years, that they keep saying China's a really big threat. China's got money and investments and interests and influence over all aspects of the British economy, universities, infrastructure, power stations, technology, like you name it. And the rest of Parliament kind of goes, yeah, but it's really inconvenient to deal with it.
The thing I have seen barely mentioned is why the body that holds our electoral roll is so hackable. Because that's, the assumption should be that someone is always trying to hack you.
I mean, how sure are we that this was particularly sensitive data? In my understanding, they got access to the electoral roll, which you can kind of do through Google, you know, generally speaking. I mean, I'm not really being completely flippant here. Chinese hacking, from what you hear about it from speaking to people who know far more than me, is huge and pervasive, but also often quite rubbish. They pick quite vulnerable targets. A lot of the time it is Chinese hacking agents who are basically working to rota, filling quotas for the hacking. The fact that they've managed to hack the electoral roll, which is broadly speaking public, and Ian Duncan Smith, I mean, I'm not sure how useful Ian Duncan Smith is in geopolitical espionage these days. Yeah. They hacked Ian Duncan Smith, Stuart MacDonald, and Tim Loughton. Well done, China, for knowing who these people are. Mm. It shows their intelligence is better than perhaps many people's. So, I mean, look, I think there's China is obviously a threat. The particular times at which Westminster chooses to focus on this threat seem to be at best random, and at worst generally serving some other agenda.
I mean, did I imagine the story about maybe 6 years ago when they found out that the US had bugged the German government?
No, absolutely, that happened, yeah.
The assumption is that everyone is trying to spy on everyone, right? It doesn't have to do with them being enemies or friends, or it's up to you to secure your shit.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the far more significant China story was one last week with someone warning, I forget who it was, it was a report in Parliament that warned about the potential for China being able to hack electric vehicles once most of the vehicles on our streets are Chinese electric vehicles, which will happen, bringing them all to a halt, causing gridlock. That kind of thing is much, much more frightening than, oh, look, they're seeing Ian Duncan Smith's WhatsApps.
But the Cameron thing is really interesting because David Cameron was the golden age of UK-China relations.
I mean, he must
relations.
Be feeling a mixture of feelings today.
Well, they dialed down the China love over the last kind of 5 years. And there's a real battle in the Conservative Party over how worried we should be about China, like the economic interests versus the security. It kind of falls down similar lines of the people who think that we should be spending more money on defence and the people who think we should be gearing all the extra money that we have, which by the way isn't any, into tax cuts, and like which of those is more likely to help the Tories win an election. So there's this like split in the party.
Now, before we get into domestic politics, I also wanted to talk a little bit about the terrorist attack in Russia. Can we trust much of what is coming out of the Kremlin, Hugo?
No, I mean, nothing ever. You know, I mean, Vladimir Putin's almost his first comment on this was that suspects have been apprehended on their way to Ukraine. Why they'd be on their way to Ukraine, indeed how they'd be on their way to Ukraine, is something of a question. The official line now is that they came from Tajikistan. Again, who knows what you can trust, generally speaking. I think the sort of really significant thing about this is, and this might sound like a slightly bizarre thing to say, but it's a reminder that there's a Russian population. You know, we've grown used to sort of thinking these last couple of years of Russia as this aggressive, militarized nation that is attacking Ukraine, which of course it is. There remains a domestic life in Russia. People are going to concerts. You think about the kind of people who are going to sort of a Moscow concert, it's more likely to be the sort of the liberal intelligentsia of Russia, who we've kind of forgotten about when we haven't been demonizing them these last few years. I think it's a worthwhile reality check, that I think.
I think it's been quite eye-opening to me how much less sympathetic the reaction online was, to the extent that I posted what I thought was a fairly neutral comment saying, you know, solidarity with the people of Russia, it's awful what happened, and loads of people went, basically, they deserve it. There's been a sort of outpouring of cruelty about it. I mean, do we make enough of an effort to distinguish between Putin and the Russian people?
No, I don't think we do. But I also think that social media is just like the worst place to say anything ever these days. And
this wasn't just social media, though. I mean, the tone of its reporting in the news was markedly different to, say, Bataclan.
It's difficult to navigate for all the reasons you mentioned. But also there's sort of huge ignorance in this country about the reality of what it means to be Russian.
Yeah.
You know, because Russia, it's a huge country. It's one of those, it's one of these sentences that I say, and I wonder if this was if I'm just sort of making it up, but I think I can say the sentence, I was for a time a visiting lecturer at the Moscow School of Political Studies, which is not a sentence I'm that comfortable saying, because it feels bizarre. Me? Why? I don't know. But I was. I spoke to them a few times, and I met a lot of young Russian students. This is maybe going back 10 years, 12 years. And their kind of their mindset, their culture, not that different from our own. They were aspirationally European. I sort of wonder often what's happened to these people. They've vanished in the noise with Russia these days.
Now, in the rare moments our media is not camped outside a royal residence, berating everyone else for not giving the royals any privacy, it does take a casual interest in politics. And it's no secret that much of the press in the UK has shaken its pom-poms pretty consistently and quite vigorously for the Tories in recent years. But Labour has been on a charm offensive / debasing exercise, depending on your point of view. Starmer grabbed the Sun's front page a few days ago with his comments on the New England football shirt. According to the Sun, he blasted the change. Do we smell a pivot? Rachel, Starmer got a little bit of pushback in his interview with Harry Cole, but all in all, remarkable soft-soaping coverage. Are they willing him into someone they can support?
I think there's an acknowledgement at The Sun and a number of papers that you can't ignore Labour anymore. You can't write them off. And an awareness that they are almost certainly going to form the next government. And once they do, if you have no relationship with them whatsoever, that is not going to be particularly conducive to good political coverage. I think, is it as cynical as that? I mean, I don't think Harry Cole has suddenly become really interested in Starmer, because I don't think Starmer has suddenly become that much more interesting. But I think if you run a media organization and you have no press connections whatsoever with the governing party, with any of the ministers. None of them like you. None of them will do you favors. None of them will give you tips. You don't have contact. None of them will go for a pint with you. Your political coverage is going to look pretty patchy quite soon.
Yeah, plus I suspect it will make it different to attack Labour if they're government, if you've always just gone at them. You need light and shade, basically, for your grievances to stand out somehow.
Yeah, although you could argue it's a bit late for that.
Is this a shift to ensure the Sun backs the winner, or is it an attempt to influence Starmer? Or is it both?
Can it not be both?
It can be both. That's your answer.
I think the Sun has never not backed a winner in an election, which I think we talked about on a podcast a couple of weeks ago. And we were talking about how, like, the Sun can see where the polls are going. It's very unlikely, I think, that they would come out and back the Conservatives, back Rishi Sunak outright, not least because they're really critical of Sunak at the moment.
Yeah.
But we talked about how they might say, you know, it's a really difficult choice for the country. We're letting our readers decide, and they might choose to not back anyone. Maybe they get more influence if they decide to back Labour outright. I'm not sure how much of Labour's comms policy at the moment is on trying to get the Sun endorsement. I know that they're very focused on getting the Times endorsement, Hugo's paper, and they're really interested in that, and that a lot of their comms and their messaging and their sort of campaign has been, what can we do to get Times journalists on board? So I think they're more interested in that space.
I think people always try and look for bigger meaning here. You know, like, political journalists are people too, man. You know, there's like 30 people in Britain who are going to vote Tory at the next election. And while a disproportionate number of them work for the Sun and the Mail and the Telegraph, still, they're largely staffed by people who are looking at the government going, hell no. You know, so there's a lot of that. Yes, the Sun likes getting behind winners. Doesn't like, I mean, any newspaper that backs the Conservatives in the next election is going to be sort of looking pretty foolish afterwards.
It's not very difficult to pick the next one, is it?
Well, exactly. Yeah.
It's not like they could influence things by a couple of percent and swing the election.
John Elledge wrote a very good piece this week pointing out that we're sort of almost in denial about how much of a foregone conclusion the next election is. You know, it's glaringly a landslide. The Tory polls are sort of dismal, and yet we still sort of think that politics should be kind of pretending, political coverage could be kind of pretending it's a balanced fight. It just isn't.
Do you think Starmer's personality, more than his positions, are the issue that puts off red tops? They want excitement. Not that a speech from Sunak couldn't put Scarface to sleep halfway through the final scene, but...
Firstly, I don't think they are that put off. I don't think his personality particularly matters. I think if he had more of a winning personality, they might worry about him rather more. Mm. You know, because he'd be more sort of populist and what have you. No, I think his whole project with the Labour Party has been to become palatable to the middle, and to the extent that tabloids like to position themselves in the middle, it's not surprising that they're receptive to it.
Mm. Do you think we'll see more newspapers start to pivot Labour's way? Are there any that are giving signs? Because Sun has been giving signs for a while, in that if there's a sort of difficult story for Labour, it tends to splash on its front page, squirrel bites, you know, homeless man, rather than, you know, they haven't been going for Starmer in the same way they went for Miliband or Corbyn.
Yeah, I think you definitely have seen on The Sun a lot of front pages that are to do with things that are not politics, which has been quite weird occasionally, the randomness of some of those front pages. I saw a really interesting chart that I think was on Unheard, which is a bizarre place to have seen this, which was the readership of various papers and which way they're supportive. And, you know, Hugo is right. The majority of readers at the majority of papers, every paper other than the Mail, are backing Labour.
Yeah.
Now, that means that even the majority of Telegraph readers are backing Labour over the Tories. I do not think the Telegraph is capable in the time between now and an election of U-turning and backing Labour. No, no. Like that is nothing.
They are heading very much for a plague on all your houses.
That's always papers that don't want to back Labour will not back anybody. Yeah. Will withhold an endorsement. I mean, the difficulty, the sort of strategic difficulty the Sun has is it always backs someone and always makes a point of backing the winner. So I think it's more about the Sun's positioning than it is about Labour's position.
The Times, I understand you might want to take some American amendment here, but it does seem to me that on an editorial level, like the choices of photos and front pages and titles, it's actually going the other way. So
this is beyond my pay grade.
You decide, right? You are entirely in charge. I'm entirely in charge. But you do look at it occasionally.
All I will say is if the Starmer opposition is making efforts to reach out to Times journalists. What am I, chopped liver? You know, not a sniff. I would say I have zero contacts among Starmer's team. Again, I mean, I never really either see or believe these stories about, you know, the duck's feet furiously waggling under the surface. A lot of things are just how they look. The stories are as they are reported. The coverage is for the reasons that anyone would cover if you were describing what was going on in British politics at the moment and you had to put a newspaper together. You'd look at Labour and you go, that seems to be going rather well. And you look at the Tories and go, that's a disaster. And when newspapers are doing that, that's often simply because that's what's going on.
Does the backing of newspapers matter in today's environment, or is it a hangover of a sort of generation of politicians where it used to, and it's just the in their muscle memory, as it were?
My own view is it matters a little, but it only ever mattered a little. Right. I think it's always been much more about newspapers positioning themselves than it has been about political parties positioning themselves. I mean, I don't say that with any evidence. That's just my assumption is it's the way newspapers. I don't think newspapers have a huge amount of control over how people vote. I mean, I can't cite the exact poll, but I seem to remember after 1997, an awful lot of people didn't know that the Sun had backed Labour, even though they were Sun readers. You know, so I think, and newspapers are less politically powerful by a long chalk than they were back then.
Yeah, I guess my only thought on that is that the fact of a right-leaning newspaper backing Labour is in itself quite newsworthy, and that might be worth a couple of points in the poll.
I think it gets journalists talking about it, and I think there is a certain amount of herd mentality in the Westminster lobby, or just people taking an interest in it because they're really interested in, one, media, two, politics. If there's a big media politics story, journalists will talk about it. Journalists have outside Twitter presences, and although not anymore, not now, our blue ticks got taken away, which I'm still very bitter about. But it's sort of, if you are trying to get a message to other people who are interested, really interested in politics, particularly your colleagues who are MPs or your colleagues who are political journalists, then yeah, it's a story and it matters. Does it matter outside of Westminster? I don't think there are that many votes in it.
I think it's just really important to get it the right way around. I think if the Mail turned around tomorrow and vastly backed Starmer, what would happen is not that Starmer's vote would go massively up. What would happen is the Mail's readership would go down because its readers would be annoyed and would leave it. And I think a lot of the time newspapers follow their readers in that kind of way. And when they swing, it's because their readers have swung.
Newspapers seem to me to have chosen a sort of wing of the Tory party, the right-leaning newspapers, or even a specific contender to support in the coming leadership election. And there's a sense that they just want this phase to be over so they can get down to the nitty-gritty of the leadership election, of their, basically, the bid of their champion for the Tory party. Is Labour essentially benefiting from the fact that none of them actually like Sunak?
Definitely. I think what you're basically asking is Labour benefiting from the fact that the Tory party is eating itself? And the answer is yes. And I have to say, like at the New Statesman, we kind of broadly divide it up. I've got some colleagues who work on Labour and I tend to work on the Tories. And my beat at the moment is much more interesting because Labour are really on message. None of them are saying anything particularly interesting that they haven't said many times before. And if they are saying something interesting, they're saying it to the Times, not to anyone else, because, you know, they're trying to build relationships there. But the Conservatives, oh my God, the number of Conservative MPs from different wings of the party, some of them from wings that you would think were the same wings of the party, briefing against each other in the most explosive terms. It's just a more interesting story. Yeah, it's a more interesting thing to cover. It's probably a more interesting thing to read about as well.
Going slightly wider, GB News has a pretty laissez-faire attitude to Ofcom rules. Will they need to be reined in before the election?
I think the problem we're trying to rein in GB News is that there is a school of thought at GB News that kind of says if Ofcom is going to come for us, bring it on. Like, that's part of their brand,
it's
being a challenger.
Cost. Yeah, Ofcom fines are a running cost.
And every time it happens, it makes their viewers they have who are very loyal even more loyal and fired up because they're under attack from Ofcom. I mean, there was that Ofcom ruling that said that they'd broken Ofcom rules by having MPs break news stories. There's this very, very thin distinction. Are they running a news program or is it a current affairs program? Yeah, and the difference between
ridiculous.
It. Yeah. But the GB News response immediately was like, it's an attack on free speech, it's an attack on a challenger channel. Like, they want that fight. And I think Ofcom is trying really hard to enforce the rules that exist in as light touch a way as possible to avoid giving them the fight that they want.
At the same time, can we have a regulated national broadcaster that's putting out, 3 hours of basically party political, advertisements out every evening for either Reform or the Tories because its presenters are from those parties?
Sure, but if you try to stop them doing it, would you not make their argument that they are being silenced? I mean, the channel's still going to run, right?
So what do we do?
Well, I mean, given the schism on the right, the fact that they're now bickering on GB News between Reform and the Tories, so, it's goes some way to solving its own problem, really, doesn't it? I mean, these are problems with sort of, UK media regulation generally, the fact that broadcasters are treated differently from online streamers, the fact that radio is different from podcasts, all that kind of stuff makes less and less sense in a sort of global context. I think there will come a time when we don't quite have regulations that work quite the same way, and it will be the job of outlets that want to be taken seriously to provide balance in order to take it seriously, to be taken seriously. I think it's a losing fight, to be honest.
For balance, Owen Jones is no longer endorsing Starmer. Will this be on the minus column or the plus column for Labour HQ?
It'll make no difference, but that's because Owen hails from a corner of British politics that devotes itself to making no difference. On that basis, I would say it's probably not of huge effect. I'd imagine quite a lot of people were surprised he was still in the Labour Party. I
was surprised.
Like a year ago, didn't he?
I thought he'd already left.
I interviewed Grace Blakely last week about her new book. Very clever, Grace Blakely. Very interesting book about sort of the collapse of capitalism. And she said something in the interview about how she just left the Labour Party, which went quite viral online. Obviously, I wouldn't suggest for a moment that Owen saw somebody else going viral for this and felt that perhaps now was his time to strike. I don't think... Look, the thing is... To be wholly serious about this, Labour's stance on Gaza, which they have messed up quite a lot of the time, is indeed costing them, I wouldn't say quite the support, but it's costing them the loyalty of an awful lot of people on the left. Mm. It's not hitting them in the polls. It's not going to hit them in the polls. Yeah. This is not a new situation. Tony Blair, when he went to war in Iraq, no one talks about Iraq at the moment. It slightly does my head in. Starmer's meant to be the great villain over Gaza. Blair literally went to war in Iraq. We were dropping bombs and sending troops. He wasn't just saying the wrong thing in interviews. He was literally in there. And yet Blair was returned in the next election and the one after that. And so I think that Gaza is damaging for party loyalty and people like Owen and people with his politics. Yes, that's significant, but it's not electorally significant at all.
Rachel, one final question. The Tory leadership ructions, which often manifest themselves via freelancing opinion pieces in a friendly paper, they seem to have died down a little bit this week. Is Sunak safe now, safe-ish? Or could the result of the local elections just undermine him fatally?
He's definitely safe until the local elections. There was this really weird attempt to oust him before that was, I think, the result of one particular MP who I won't name, but who kind of has been trying to get momentum behind Suella Braverman or Kemi Badenoch or Robert Jenrick, and when none of the right-wing ones worked, suddenly went, it could be Penny Morden, and then briefly, it could be Tom Tiggenhat. And it was really just one MP who I think is absolutely desperate to see him gone, doesn't really care who replaces him. But I think the best comment on this came from Ben Wallace, the former defence secretary, who said, like, yeah, basically all is lost, but it's too late now, so we might as well get on with it, which I think is the mood of the majority of Conservative MPs.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably true. Counterpoint, where when things are awful, they can still be pretty bad and better. You know, are you confident that Penny Mordaunt wouldn't move the dial by 2%?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, because I'm not. And so I'd imagine they're not either.
That has always been my view, that much of the media is treating Tory as a sort of entity, but actually it's a sort of murmuration of starlings, which might be scared in whatever direction at any given moment.
Well, they got rid of Boris Johnson by accident. I mean, there was a move to get rid of him, but they didn't think they were at the point of getting rid of him at the point they didn't know he was gone, and they didn't know what to do.
Very good of you to protect Simon Clarke, though. Right, next up, time to choose our hero and villain of the week. Who is this week's Scott Pilgrim and who is this week's Scott Benton? Rachel.
Well, I couldn't think of a hero. I was going to go for Scott Benton, who is the Conservative MP for Blackpool South, who was embroiled in a lobbying scandal where he basically said to companies, if you give me lots of money, I will talk to ministers on your behalf, which is kind of the definition of a lobbying scandal, and faced a recall petition. And midway through the recall petition has decided to just quit of his own volition, and very decent of him to do that.
So, really, though?
No, absolutely not.
Or did he see which way the recall petition winds were blowing?
I mean, obviously that. I was just very short of ideas for this week.
Let's hope your pitch for villain is better this week.
Oh, my pitch for villain is HMRC.
Okay.
Which last week announced it was shutting the phone lines for anyone doing a self-assessment, having queries. But also HMRC in general. My colleague Will Dunn at the New Statesman has written some features about all the ways in which HMRC knows about scams and tax fraud and allows individuals, particularly small business owners, to be kind of dragged into those and then subsequently hits them with tax bills for tens or even hundreds of thousands of pounds and then goes, yeah, it's your fault. We knew about this scam, but, you know, you should have taken better advice. And people are like, I went to an accountant and they said this was the right thing to do. I think this is the next post office scandal. I think HMRC just deciding it was going to close the phone lines for half the year because they can't be bothered to answer the phone to people who desperately want to pay their tax but aren't able to do it right because it's such a complicated system. I think absolute villains. They U-turned within, I think, 24, 48 hours.
Memories of self-assessment being so fresh, I reckon you have a reasonable chance there.
I have just done my self-assessment.
Yes.
Can you tell?
How about you, Hugo?
My hero is Tom Cruise.
Okay.
I saw a picture of him just this morning running across a bridge while filming Mission Impossible 72 or wherever on now. Tom Cruise is now 61, and as such, he looks only slightly less haggard than I do, being 15 years younger. And I just thought he was striking a powerful blow for middle-aged men appearing in action films. All of a sudden, I look like an action hero because Tom Cruise has hit 61. Thank you, Tom. I'm grateful.
Okay. Yeah, 61.
It's not a political
61
answer.
61 is not middle-aged, I'm afraid. But anyway, go on.
No, that's it. That's my hero.
And your villain?
My villain. Okay. So I thought long and hard about this. My villain is Nike over the football shirts.
Okay.
Right. Now, important caveats here. I don't know what the last shirt looked like. Don't really know what this shirt looked like. I paid attention, but I've forgotten because I don't care. Also, I'm Scottish and I don't give a shit. But that being said, I'm trying really hard to care about this because everyone else is and I want to be involved. So that's it. Football shirts. Boo.
So I think HMRC is going to take villain of the week.
Robbed.
And Tom Cruise will take hero
but
of the week.
But only because Scott Benton can't.
Well, I'm a gay man of a certain age and Tom Cruise basically would take hero any week. Now, the name Thatcher is a word considered more indelicate than fuckpuffin in some political circles, but lately, Labour politicians have been painting the air blue with a T-bomb. Starmer, Reeves and Lammy have all recently referenced the unnameable, sparking rage from the frequently raging. But should we care about her name being mentioned? Is it a sign of weakness that she still holds such power for some? Hugo, was Reeves' reference to Thatcher misconstrued, or was she sending a deliberate message?
Well, it's interesting on this, because she didn't actually mention Thatcher.
No.
All the coverage of her
sort
speech.
She mentioned 79.
She mentioned the late... So she could have been talking about Star Wars. Who knows? you know, it was very odd. I looked keenly to see what... We were talking about this last week. I looked keenly to see what she said about Thatcher. Turned out nothing. The point she made was that we're in a transitional period like the end of the 70s. Yes, she knows what she's doing. That the economy has to dramatically change like it did in the 70s. That's a little bit of a nod towards people who want to... Who are relieved by the thought of Labour being in the centre. But it's not like she did. I mean, you know, David Cameron called himself the heir to Blair. You know, that's positioning. This is just, I mean, I don't think it's hugely significant.
And it's not controversial, is it? I mean, that period was transitional.
Yeah, sure. You know, it dramatically transformed the economy. I mean, and she did say that she wanted to transform the economy differently. I think if you're going to talk about a time when we have an economy and whole sort of like structures of governance, structures of the country itself that are falling apart and we need a massive sense of renewal, then it's not a bad time to pick, particularly if you don't particularly want to talk about 1997.
Was there economics meat in the speech that was missed because of the Thatcher sort of brouhaha, or is it still more of her holding pattern?
I mean, my understanding of economics is sketchy at best. I couldn't find much. There was more talk about more controls over what government can and can't do.
Oh, right. Yeah,
which in a way sort of harks back to the OBR and also, or for example, giving the Bank of England control of interest rates, that kind of thing, government disempowering government so as to be taken more seriously. But I don't think there was a lot of meat there because, I mean, she knows, as Starmer knows, as everybody knows, that the path to victory for Labour is by just basically saying we'll be like the other lot, but not shit, and that's the message she wanted to put across, I think.
Why does the mere mention of Thatcher just make some people see red, Rachel?
I think there are a lot of people on the left, we have already talked about Owen Jones leaving the Labour Party, who seem quite hostile to the idea of a Labour Party that could actually win. And I think a lot of it was that, like, it seems like a betrayal to have a Labour leader, a Labour shadow chancellor, saying anything that could be vaguely construed as not all Tories ever are evil and we shouldn't take any lessons from anything, even if those lessons are we're in kind of similar times and we need to do something radical. I don't know. I found the row over it like a bit confusing because she didn't say she wanted to be like Thatcher. She actually made specific distinctions saying that unlike what happened after 1979, we needed growth, but it had to be, was it broad-based and inclusive? And that the problem with what happened after 1979 was that, yes, the economy grew, but it was very unequal. Like, she made all of those points. And I think in positioning terms, yes, this is about signalling that this is a Labour Party that is trying to win votes of people who didn't vote for you last time, which I sort of feel like is the point.
Yeah. I mean, it was the same with Starmer, actually, a couple of months ago. He said, basically, there are prime ministers who make their mark and prime ministers who don't. And the prime ministers who make their mark, like Thatcher and Blair, I'd quite like to be like one of them. And everyone went, he wants to be like Thatcher. Burn him. I mean, is there any denying that Thatcher defined an era and changed this nation profoundly? You don't have to agree with it. You don't have to support her politics merely to acknowledge that historical fact.
Yeah, that she was effective. And you can say that you do not like the effect of it, or those effects were negative, but you can't deny that she was effective. Actually, I think the Conservatives have almost the reverse problem at the moment, which is that they've been in power for 14 years and they can't point to any achievements or changes or big ways that they have changed the country in line with their conservative ideology. You've got a lot of argument at the moment in the Conservative Party of what have they done with that opportunity. I also think there's a weird thing that goes on with Tories where they all latch on to Thatcher's legacy from. I think both Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss in the 2022 leadership contest both claimed to be the heir of Thatcher in different ways.
I mean, in the most superficial ways possible, Thatcher, I think, would be mortified by today's.
I think she would be even more mortified by the mid-ranking Tory MPs or even sort of candidates. You ask any of them, you know, who's a Conservative politician or whose ideas that you aspire to, they only ever name two: Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher. Mm. It's the boring basic ChatGPT answer of what defines a Tory.
Hugo, is Thatcher actually unpopular or popular, or and is that moving with time, even though she's long gone?
Well, I mean, she stopped being prime minister, 32 years ago? So I'd imagine there's an awful lot of voters who remember her not at all and only really understand the caricature now. Something that's very interesting, though, about Thatcher's legacy at the moment, a lot of the stuff we're struggling with as a nation at the moment does go back to Thatcher, does go back to the dismantling of unions, to the dismantling of civic identity and replacing it with a sort of individualism.
And practically to the privatisation of water.
Absolutely.
Of rail. Leading
eventually towards the Royal Mail, all that kind of stuff.
Selling off council houses.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. All that. And there may have been the odd Rifkin involved in these processes as well. Who knows? But all that kind of stuff really planted the seeds of where we are now. And you see that particularly, it's almost like a lot of that was concealed for quite a long time. Because frankly, in the run-up to Brexit as a country, we were largely prosperous. We felt like we were going somewhere. Mm-hmm. There were problems with austerity and everything, but still the country was largely growing. And when you sort of lose that momentum as a country, you stop and look back at where you are and you look at where it started. That's where it started. So she's actually now a much more relevant figure, I think, in politics than she was, say, 10 years ago, interestingly.
That is interesting. Also, much of the hagiography around Thatcher kind of misses the first few years that were quite problematic, the last few years that were quite problematic. It's like she exists now in people's memory only at her peak, as it were. Is that something that happens generally, speaking with politics? It doesn't seem to be happening with Blair.
The opposite.
Everyone
with Blair
seems to be remembering like Blair's worst moment. So what are the factors that control that?
I think the difference between Thatcher and Blair is how their relative parties then dealt with the legacy. So in the same way that the Conservative Party, they are obsessed with how brilliant Thatcher was, so much so that you will get like really modern problems like, how do we regulate social media? Or, you know, what should we do about, I don't know, space? And you'll genuinely get Conservative politicians being like, well, what would Margaret Thatcher have done? Like, we don't know and it doesn't matter. We've moved on. Whereas the Labour Party, for a number of years after Blair and Brown, seemed very embarrassed to talk about the fact that Blair won elections and changed the country in a lot of ways. They didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to talk about the legacy. So I think
that's really interesting, isn't it?
I think the obsession with the Thatcher's peak is that that's how her party remember her. Mm. And we don't get that with Blair, because Blair's party only talks about, or has until recently, only talked about the downfall and the negatives of it. So, you know, that's part of it as well. But I also think that Thatcher, from what I understand, was in some ways, a much more nuanced politician than she is often caricatured as now. There are big debates going on again in the Conservative Party about would Margaret Thatcher have supported Brexit or not. There are things that she said at various points in her political life that were pro the European economic areas. Then she wore the jumper with all the flags. Then there were sort of points where she was sort of more Eurosceptic. There were points when she talked about the importance of tackling climate change and protecting the environment and the importance of passing on something to the next generation. That is not a type of Thatcherism that you see those on the right of the Conservative Party who are anti-net zero talking about a lot at all. I just think it's more nuanced than anyone wants to talk about.
Politicians are always sort of their time. Thatcher then wouldn't have supported Brexit. Of course she wouldn't. No senior Conservative then would have supported Brexit. Thatcher now might have done. Thatcher now might be hosting a show on GB News next to Jacob Rees-Mogg. You know, you don't know what happened. I mean, the nature and status of people from various different wings of the party changes over time depending on circumstances. It makes all these sort of debates about, as you say, what Thatcher would do now. Like, who knows? It's meaningless.
What would Thatcher do about Elon Musk? Who knows? Who cares? And then yes. One thing, she wouldn't interview him about how great he was at AI. She wouldn't have done that, I don't think.
Yes, I need to very gently push back against that because I feel quite sure she wouldn't be hosting a show on GB News. I don't know. I don't know why, but it seems to me that whatever she was, she believed in her own stature more than being a sort of VJ. Right, we've reached the end of the show, so it's time for escape routes. What displacement activity have we engaged in to fill the void in politics during a week of royal news dominating the agenda? Hugo.
I am thoroughly hooked on For All Mankind on Apple.
Okay.
Either of you seen that?
No.
It's an Apple sort of sci-fi drama. It's now in its fourth series. It's passed me by at first, despite the fact I'm a TV critic. Just shows how good I am at that.
I'm making a note of it.
It's basically what it's about. It starts in the 1960s, and it has the Russians winning the space race, narrowly, as in the Russians getting to the moon first, and then it constructs a parallel history that goes forward from them with that having happened in a manner that sort of slightly weakens America, slightly boosts the Soviet Union, makes them eventually work together in the space race and then apart and then together again. Currently on about season four, by which point we're in, I think, 2003, all on this parallel history. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I like What Ifs. That sounds interesting. I interviewed recently A.C. Grayling on his new book, Who Owns the Moon, which is very, very on point with that because that race is very, very relevant.
Yeah, that's on.
Yeah, that's out soon on the bunker. How about you, Rachel?
Emo music.
Okay. just in that. General. So you've just discovered this, well, have you?
No, absolutely okay. Not. I discovered this very much when I was 14, and it was the soundtrack to my life for many years. And then I lost all my music in a computer crash, and I only got Spotify for my birthday in October, which I got, as I said on the show, specifically to get into Taylor Swift. And I've now got into Taylor Swift. She's pretty good. Who knew? But I realised that Spotify lets you listen to anything, which I didn't realise. And it does you playlists. It does you playlists of things that it thinks you'll like based on other things that it thinks you'll like. And I got this emo playlist, and suddenly my adolescence is coming back to me in the most like angry, full-on cathartic way. You know, My Chemical Romance and 30 Seconds to Mars and Paramore and all of this stuff. It speaks to me now in the state that I'm in about British politics in a very similar way that it spoke to me when I was 15 about being heartbroken. And
why didn't
I love
you
it.
Do as a sort of Spotify playlist? I think our listeners would love that.
You want me to just it would just be
do an emo playlist.
It would be My Chemical Romance and Taylor Swift, and that would basically be.
Are you my 15-year-old daughter? I think you are.
We would get on.
Yeah, I think so. Well, you'd certainly share music. Yeah.
So mine is Three Body Problem on Netflix. I'm four episodes in, and I am very aware of being manipulated into watching the next scene and the next scene and the next episode. And I quite like it. So I haven't decided yet whether this is in a sort of Dan Brown way or not. but it's very, very enjoyable, the mystery in it, as it were.
I've seen all eight. I'm special.
Right.
It's good. Mm. It's a bit erratic. I mean, I think it's really good, don't get me wrong. But it's a bit, some bits are not very good and some bits are amazing.
Bits
right?
of it have sent me studying for several hours, which I always like about a thing.
I've also learned what a three-body problem is, which I didn't know that before.
Exactly.
In a way, this podcast is a three-body problem right now.
Yes. And that's the end of the Tuesday edition of Oh God, What Now? Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thank you to our third body, Hugo.
Thank you very much.
Don't forget, if you're a Patreon backer, we're on a drive to ask everyone to consider going up a tier. An extra £1 or £2 a month from you, if you can find it, would make a huge difference to us. You'll be helping us to navigate some choppy waters out in the ocean of advertising and making sure it's plain sailing for the good ship, Oh God, What Now? Go to memberships on your Patreon page and choose upgrade. It's really simple. And now some thanks to our latest Patreon backers.
Hello, and big thanks for your generosity to Elliot Bishop, Joshua, NC, and Pip Wilcox.
A massive shout out from me to our wonderful new backers, Angela Rosen, Lou Cutterford, Suzanne O'Leary and Andrew McCluskey.
And finally, hello and welcome from me to new backer Jean Mollis. And welcome home, come on in and close the door to Prodigal Sons and returning supporters Chris Kendall, James Smith and Richard Teversham. Oh God, what now? We'll be back on Thursday for our backers and Friday morning for everyone else. Don't be everyone else, backers. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
Oh God, what now? Was written and presented by Alex Andreu, with Rachel Cunliffe and Hugo Rifkin. The producer was Chris Jones, with audio production from Robin Lieber. Video production was by Kieran Leslie, with art by Jim Parra. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and Oh God, What Now? Is a Podmasters production.